You're listening to The Critical Point on aerogel.org. I'm your host, Steven Steiner.
This is the second in a multi-part series called The People Who Reinvented Aerogel, and today it is my pleasure to have the opportunity of speaking with Dr. Alex Gash from Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, best known for what is popularly called the Gash Prep, namely epoxide-assisted gelation of metal salts for producing gels and aerogels. Dr. Gash, welcome.
Thank you, Steven. Happy to be here today.
So first of all, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where are you from? Where'd you go to school, et cetera?
I grew up in California, Northern California. I went to University of California, Davis as an undergraduate, where I got a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry. I went and worked for a couple years out in industry, and then went back to graduate school about 4 years later at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. I got a PhD in inorganic chemistry there in 1999. And then came actually directly to Livermore to work as a postdoc, where a lot of my postdoc work was centered on sort of refining and exploring the methodology you talked about, the epoxide-assisted gelation of metal oxides. That was a great deal of my postdoc work here. And then since my postdoc ended, I've been hired on as a staff scientist here for the last 7 years. Specifically, what I look more at are traditional energetic mixes, metal oxides, and metal fuels. So using salt gel processing, not necessarily entirely aerogels, although we have made aerogel energetic composites, so composites that release their energy in the form of heat and light and gas generation.
So for the audience, energetic materials meaning things that go boom and pop.
Pyrotechnics, explosives, propellants.
So this is to say you've made explosive aerogels.
Yeah, we've made aerogels that... frameworks that are either oxidizer or fuel, and then we've been able to dope the rest, the porous structure with, either an oxidizer or a fuel. So we have a fuel oxidizer mix, and you can, you generate gas that way. If you have hydrocarbon fuel, if you have metal fuel, generally you generate hot metals, and usually high enthalpies of reactions, rapid reactions. So my research spans the area of salt gel science and methodology and energetic materials.
So were you first introduced to aerogels when you came to Livermore then?
Yeah, I had a very small experience in graduate school. Then my inorganic background was in synthetic chemistry as well as characterization of two-dimensional or layered compounds, mostly metal sulfides. So, but one of the projects involved a little bit of salt gel chemistry. So I'd never made an aerogel before I came to Livermore, but I had made zero gels before.
Okay, so related material.
Yeah. But there, Livermore is where, I definitely learned the science and art to making aerogels.
So what is so special about aerogels that make them interesting for energetic material applications?
Well, for the energetic material application, aerogel is a way to make a nanomaterial, essentially. It's made up of nanoparticles, right? Well, in all of the reactions that we look at, the energetic reactions we look at, we have a mixture of two distinct phases of an oxidizer and a fuel. You can imagine if you have great big particle sizes of oxidizer and fuel, the reactions are solid-solid diffusion-controlled reactions at interfaces. And so if you've got large particle sizes, you have sort of a limited amount of interfacial contact between those.
Well, by making everything nanostructured, you can get a lot more surface area.
You actually, the reactions are still diffusion controlled, but the reactants don't have to diffuse as far to undergo their reactions. So what we see when we go to nanomaterials, we see enhancement in burning rate, energy release, initiation properties. They behave nearly entirely different than their micron size counterparts. Atomically, they're the same composite. Their behaviors are so different, they might as well be different.
So, but making it nanostructured in the form of an aerogel just gives it that much extra chemistry.
Right, and now there's a ton of approaches to it. What I've done here at Livermore is we're using sol gel as sort of a practical approach, what we feel is a practical approach to the fabrication, formulation, and processing of energetic materials, because sol gel is a very straightforward method in many instances. It's scalable. It's got a long history. There are a lot of different ways to make nanomaterials, and salt gel gives us the appropriate balance of cost and safety and, ease, essentially, which is a big deal. Is if it's going to be used widely, people have to be able to, it has to be fairly straightforward. And we feel that That's what Sol-Gel gives us.
So when people think about energetic aerogels, what are these aerogels made of? What kind of a metal oxide, or what would you make them out of?
So what Sol-Gel chemistry allows us to do is allows us to make a nanoporous, nano-sized, nano-structured framework, okay? And we can make that framework out of metal oxides, for example, things like iron oxide, nickel oxide, tungsten trioxide, manganese oxide, all are desirable oxidizers. Those metal oxides, when combined with particular fuel metals, for example, aluminum or boron or silicon, so combined with the native metal, make a class of reactions called thermite reactions. And the standard thermite reaction is iron oxide and aluminum, but many metal oxides and metals undergo that reaction. It's an oxidation-reduction reaction. And so what Sol-Gel allows us to do is put this nanostructured framework together. It also, while we're making the metal oxide, for example, doing the synthesis, we can actually suspend the fuel metal in solution with it, and we get the oxide phase growing around the dispersed fuel, and what you get is this composite that's very well mixed down on the nanoscale. It has a high surface area, and we see propagation, you know, for the traditional iron oxide aluminum thermite reaction, the aerogel material tend to burn about four times faster than the zero gel.
Four times faster, wow.
Yeah, about four times faster. And the aerogel materials burn about a little under 900 meters a second is what we've seen.
So take the case of an iron oxide aerogel with aluminum nanoparticles dispersed in its pores.
Yeah.
Let's compare that with if I just took iron oxide powder and aluminum powder and mixed it up. How would you compare those two?
Yeah, no, that's the key issue. So with for micron-sized material, you might get 10 meters a second.
Okay.
You know, if you had the right mix of stuff. So, you know, making a thermite-type reaction. The other side of it is you can actually make carbon-based stuff, hydrocarbon-based materials, resorcinol formaldehyde, the phenolic formaldehyde.
Sure.
And so what another approach is now you can make a skeleton out of a hydrocarbon or a carbon skeleton where that's actually the fuel, okay?
Okay.
And then you, in those instances, you can have dissolved oxidizer like ammonium nitrate or ammonium perchlorate in the pores there. And then when you actually dry the material, that oxidizer precipitates out in the pores, so you get a fine mix of oxidizer and fuel that way too, where instead, in the first case, the skeleton was the oxidizer. Now the skeleton is the fuel. What's different about the hydrocarbon is that the products of the oxidizer and the hydrocarbon mixture, those are actually gaseous. So with the thermite reaction, you get a lot of solid products, hot, solid.
Liquid iron.
Yes, exactly, liquid. But with the other mixture, so say resorcinol formaldehyde and ammonium perchlorate or something like that, you get carbon dioxide, water. Those are some of the byproducts, carbon monoxide. So you're actually making, so that is actually more like a classic explosive, because then you can actually, those types of reactions, you can get up to supersonic and actually do a detonation. So a detonation is typically things above about 7,000 meters a second.
Okay. So basically we can make aerogels out of thermites of various sorts, and we can make something that's kind of like rocket fuel that ends up completely vaporizing.
Yeah. Well, that's completely, And so those types of energetic materials, with almost all gaseous products, are very desirable because they can do a lot of pressure volume work, whether it's propelling something or rupturing something or, you know, pushing a piston or, you know, inflating an airbag, all kinds of things.
Very cool. And I think that's probably something our audience never really knew much about, was that you can make such useful materials and explosive materials with aerogels.
Well, your airbag, you know, the air in your airbag comes from it's not a detonating explosive, but it's burning really fast, generates gas real fast.
So let's talk a little bit about the gash prep. So the epoxide-assisted gelation of metal salts was probably one of the most significant developments in aerogel technology in the past two decades. Basically, enabled scientists to prepare aerogels of metal oxides, which were either extremely difficult to prepare in the past or just impossible to prepare in the past. So people frequently call this the gash prep, but as you mentioned before, it was somewhat under development when you came to Livermore. Can you talk about where it came from and what your role was in that?
I agree. A lot of the work I did was sort of expanding and refining the method and getting a little bit more at the mechanism behind how it works. It wasn't unknown. There's some work the Japanese done in Japan back in the mid-80s that used propylene oxide to make alumina gels. They never made aerogels out of the material. They just used a gel. Also was used here at Livermore by a colleague of mine, Tom Tillotson, back in the early 90s to make some lanthanide-doped silicon oxide glass material for laser materials. So people had used it as a sol gel method, but typically they made zero gels or made some kind of glass out of it. What I did was looked at it and making aerogels, so supercritically extracting the solvent instead of air drying it, and then just looked at where on the periodic table we could take it. And you can take it a lot of places on the periodic table. So we looked at a bunch of different things. It works for a lot of them. It doesn't work for some.
Which ones does it not work for?
Well, we have not. We had a little trouble with some of the late first row transition metal elements, copper, nickel, zinc, cobalt, that type of thing. We figured out that you can do it with nickel, and actually a former colleague of ours, Louisa Hope Weeks at Texas Tech, actually just published recently published a paper on making zinc oxide.
Are they monolithic materials?
Yeah, they are monolithic. It's a chemistry materials publication from late last year.
Well, we'll be sure to put that on the website.
Yeah, no, and Louisa was a postdoc and actually a staff member here for a few years before she decided to go into academics, and so we still keep in fairly good contact with her, and she's doing some nice work. But we haven't really tried to apply it to any. It works well for early transition metals. It works for all the lanthanides, actually. That's very nice.
The early transition metals being the ones on the left side of the pyramid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it seems to work real well for the block of early transitions. You get sort of late and second row, when things are a little rarer and their coordination tend to be a little more square planar or linear, don't seem to work as well. That we know a little less about. It works pretty well for actually main group elements too: gallium oxide, indium oxide, tin oxide, aluminum oxide.
Can you make silicon oxide aerogels or silica aerogels using this technique?
We have. We haven't really characterized it very much, but
what would you use? Silicon tetrachloride?
Yeah, we've used silicon tetrachloride.
Are the gels clear?
I don't remember, to be honest with you. We did a little bit of it. I remember it, them not being as nice as the alkoxide approach.
But certainly for the other metals, for example, aluminum oxide aerogels previously were very difficult to make. You had to use aluminum trisec butoxide, which is this gooey honey-like
stuff.
It reacts with water and the air, and it's awful. And titanium, I remember titanium dioxide aerogels being very difficult to prepare before this technique. And you could only get white kind of crumbly gels. Now you can get clear, very high-quality gels.
Yeah, I think it's helped. I think probably the thing that it's helped the most is I think it provides it's a very straightforward method, and it's really, it gives you a much bigger chemistry toolbox to play with. Naval Research Lab has used this method quite extensively to prepare magnetic aerogels. Jeff Long and Deborah Rawlson doing some neat work there with looking at these gels that if you put them in a magnetic field, their pore structure changes. You get them to sort of flex. And the other thing is it's nice because we make actually quite a number of mixed metal oxides too.
So putting more than one.
Oh, yeah. Binary is very common. We've made some ternaries. We've been looking at ternaries recently because they tend to, not using the aerogel, actually, just using this approach as a synthetic method to make a glass. Some ternary glasses with three elements mixed in there, they have a hard time crystallizing, so you tend to frustrate them, so you can actually, they stay amorphous.
And that's advantageous for a number of different applications.
Yeah, it's nice for bulk alumina glasses are not really well known, but they're actually very, very hard, and if you can make them transparent, they're good armor material.
So let's take a step back a little bit and talk about the epoxide-assisted gelation reaction from a layman's point of view. So what exactly do you mix? What do you put together? What do you need to think about when you do that, and what do you get out of it?
So just a brief overview. We use typically inorganic salts, so nitrates, chlorides, acetates work pretty well.
For example, if we're interested in making a gel with iron, we could use iron nitrate or iron acetate or iron chloride.
Right, exactly. And what's nice about those salts is that they tend to be very stable, tend to be very inexpensive. They're soluble in a lot of different solvents.
Water?
Yeah, water. Actually, water works. We don't use water as much as we use things like low alcohols, methanol, ethanol, propanol, that type of stuff.
Or sometimes, as I understand, half alcohol, half water.
Yeah, no, that's true. We've seen sort of a solvent effect on morphology of the material. for the alumina system, Ted Bauman, a colleague of mine, did a lot on. But you can dissolve the salts, and then we add actually an organic epoxide, which they're used to basically consume acid in organic reactions, and that's essentially what it does here.
So what kinds of compounds, like by name, we have propylene oxide.
Propylene oxide, and so if you were drawing out the, it's essentially a triangle with an oxygen and two carbons at the corners. Your carbons have got hydrogens or aliphatic groups hanging off them. And if you tried to make a molecular model set of that, you'd see how strained that ring really is. It's not in a very comfortable position. It likes to ring open, and if you have it in the presence of protons, and we believe the protons are coming from the hydrated metal ions in solution there,
okay.
you pull up protons, and then the ring actually opens. It gets attacked by a nucleophile, and now it's made a substituted alcohol, essentially.
Okay.
And it's a one-way reaction. That guy isn't going to fold back up and give its proton back. So it's the epoxide is not a catalyst. It actually gets consumed in the reaction, so it's a reactant. But what you get at the end, though, is you get this net consumption of protons, and it can be fairly slow depending on you can control the rate of that by controlling the structure of the epoxide. There's a number of different epoxides that are commercially available. There are some four-member ring epoxides, which actually are slow, and you get some real unique results if you do this reaction very slowly. So you can control the chemical reactivity of it, that which changes your rate, and then you get this slow homogeneous pH rise throughout solution. So then, as opposed to adding like a strong base where you drip wise, where you get these local concentrations, very high concentrate pH gradients, I think you get a real uniform pH gradient throughout solution, and that enables you to get these really nice small sol particles to start to nucleate and grow, and then they eventually, you hit the right threshold and they cross-link and you form this nice gel, and it works for a number of metal oxides.
So effectively what we do is we take some salt of a metal, like aluminum chloride or iron nitrate or something, we dissolve it in some concentration in a solution of an alcohol or water or
mm-hmm.
a number of solvents. We add an epoxide like propylene oxide or epichlorohydrin, or I think
mm-hmm.
there's a couple other ones that work.
Yep.
You mix it up and it kind of just happens, right?
Yeah, I mean, and depending on, you can tweak the concentration, you can tweak the temperature, you can, different metal ions react at different rates. I'd say for the most part, most of these make gels within a few hours under a given set of circumstances, but some take longer, a day or two.
So then once they've gelled, you need to wash them or soak them.
That's a good point. The epoxide that reacts, what you get is that substituted alcohol. Well, that's actually, what's nice is those are liquids. So you can actually wash most of those out of solution, you're exactly right, by washing in ethanol or acetone or ethyl
acetate. You mean basically just soaking in.
Soaking, yeah, exactly. And so you get, you can clean them up a great deal, then go ahead and do your supercritical extraction or your air drying if you want to make a zero gel.
So one of the things that I think our audience will find interesting about this technique is the number of colorful aerogels, not just the blue cast Rayleigh scattering
right.
silica aerogels
right.
that people are used to seeing from the NASA websites. Things that are blue and green and pink and orange.
Yep.
Of all the different aerogels you've prepared, what are the most vibrantly colored ones?
Well, it depends. I think we're getting those color transitions because we're getting at metals that can have multiple oxidation states that undergo charge transfer and, under visible conditions. Things, iron oxide. Iron oxide's interesting because we've made a number of different phases of it, and you get different colors for different phases.
So basically the same.
Yeah, you've got a nice red phase for hematite. You can, ferry hydrite's kind of brown. Maghemite, which is magnetic, is actually black.
So magnetic aerogels.
Yeah, we did a little bit of that, and Jeff Long and Deborah Rawlson expanded on it a fair amount. So we've made a magnetic material.
Very cool. So what are the most brilliantly colored ones that you've prepared that come to mind?
If you look at the transition metal salts, and they can be highly colored. Nickel makes a nice apple green aerogel material.
Cool. Is it clear or is it opaque?
No, it's pretty opaque. If you want to get clear, presidinium oxide is actually green. It's very nice.
The lanthanum clear. Oxide.
Yeah. And holmium oxide is actually pink. It's actually, and that's actually usually very clear.
Very clear.
It looks like silica that you've added a little pink dye to, really. It makes a nice aerogel.
And we have a number of pictures of these kinds of aerogels on aerogel.org, yeah. So take a look in the photo gallery and you'll see what Alex is talking about.
Yeah, tungsten oxide's a nice yellow, canary yellow. Kind of opaque. Too transparent.
So there's lots of opportunities here beyond just the interesting chemical and insulating properties that aerogels have, but maybe some artistic potential is enabled by this technique.
Exactly.
So another question for you. What's in the pipeline at Livermore? What's exciting that we can look to the future to expect coming out of your group?
Well, one of the things we're looking at, and we're not the only ones looking at that, is to try and extend the classes of materials that you can make aerogels out of to other materials. And I'm sure there are other folks that are featured on this website that, you know, Stephanie Brock being one, looking at metal chuck oxygenides. And we've done a little bit of work in that area also. But we're actually a little more focused on actually seeing if we can make metal-based aerogels.
Metal aerogels.
Metal-based aerogel materials.
This is, of course, an area that I'm particularly interested in.
No, I'd say that's really cutting edge there.
The holy grail of modern aerogel science.
The other thing we're trying to do, and it somewhat dovetails in with that, is we're looking at using aerogels as templates for other materials.
To template
materials in the pores of the aerogel, remove the aerogel somehow through carbonization or through dissolution, and get sort of the reverse, an inverse aerogel, essentially.
Wow. So what would an inverse aerogel be useful for?
Well, we are highly interested in foams here. We make a lot of laser targets for high energy density physics experiments. We have the National Ignition Facility here on site. It's one of probably our key project going on here at the lab. We're building the world's largest laser, and with that laser, we hope to initiate and confine and study fusion here in a controlled manner with very, very small foam targets. We need foams because we induce shocks in these things and compress these foams and get tremendous heating, and that's essentially a very simple, oversimplified explanation of how we do it.
But anyway,
we look at all different types of plastics, plastic foams, and having the aerogel type structure, though, is really key and important. And so that's important. We are interested in a lot of things related to foams.
So actually, aerogels end up being not only interesting materials, but very important for fusion, which is for the future of energy, obviously.
We are a weapons lab, so we know a lot about fusion, but no one's ever really studied fusion in a lab.
Of course.
And that's the goal of the whole NIF program, the National Ignition Facility out here.
It's
a tremendous facility itself. Just building it was, you know, a many, many year project. But now, you know, we have years of experiments to do, and we support targets for that. So we are making the targets that they're looking. So there's all different types of density mismatches. You want to look at different elements for particular reasons.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. So let me ask you this question. What's your favorite type of aerogel?
I think I'd have to go with the iron oxide.
Iron oxide.
The one I did most of the work on, and it's a real versatile chemistry. You can switch oxidation states. You can get magnetic material out of it. It's a real colorful material. It's a good aerogel. You can make pretty robust monoliths out of it. I think
So colorful, potentially magnetic, versatile.
Yeah, it's got a lot of different properties, exactly. There's all kinds of knobs you can twist on iron. And, you know, it's simple, and it's rust in some respects.
Right. Really exciting.
It's a rusty aerogel, but there's some interest. Some interesting things.
And for our audience out there, we have a preparation under the Make section of our website on how to make iron oxide aerogels of your very own. And you'll find that it's actually not as difficult as you might think, thanks largely in part to the efforts of Alex Gash and his colleagues at Lawrence Livermore. So, Alex, I really appreciate your time today.
Sure.
Do you have any parting words you'd like to...
I think years ago people thought this was an area that was, I wouldn't say dead-ended, but a lot of things had been figured out. I disagree with that completely. I think there's a lot still to be learned here. There's still some... interesting science and technology. There are some interesting scientific goals as well as technologies where this you can really potentially apply this in a number of areas. And I think as we've noted with the way things, especially in the energy sector, evolving costs and whatnot, they're getting much more interested in aerogels for insulating materials again.
Absolutely.
So there's definitely going to be, I think, a future for these materials. There's all kinds of, taking these materials and making, Deborah Rawlson, one of the things that she says that I really, really resonates with me is she says, one of the things that's neat about sol gel chemistry and aerogels, you can actually make a nanostructure that you can actually pick up. You can actually make it macro, which, very few nanomaterials can you do that with.
Right, it's a nanotechnology, but it's something you can hold in your hand.
Yeah, exactly. It's nano, all the way up to macro.
Absolutely.
Can take nanostructures and put them together in something macro. So it's an exciting field. I encourage people to get into it. And if people are interested, it's easy to contact me and we can talk.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the goal of aerogel.org is, to get people involved and to get them to realize that they can understand and participate in nanotechnology and make a difference in things like energy and technologies, which aerogels will enable. Well, thank you again, Alex, for your time. This has been an aerogel.org podcast. I'm your host, Steven Steiner. Remind you that aerogel's not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved.